You may have to do an encore if you're not careful.
Okay.
We're now going to have our question and answer session. We have some roving mics around. There are about four. So when you get the mic, if you just tell us who you are, and please, would you ask a quick question? We don't have much time. And I know that Professor Chomsky will oblige us too with quick answers.
But I'm going to take
one liberty and just throw a very quick one at you before I go to the to the audience. Has there ever been any overseas military intervention by the United States that you've been in favor of over the last 60 or 70 years?
Well, you could generalize that question. Has there ever been any military intervention by anybody that was justifiable? There probably are a few, but it's very difficult to find any. There are very thick legal tomes studying humanitarian intervention, and one of the interesting features of them is that they cannot find any bona fide examples. They can find bona fide examples of military interventions that happen to have benign effects, but if you look at them, the results are not terribly attractive to us. So take, say, Pearl Harbor. I don't know anyone who goes out on the streets and celebrates Pearl Harbor every December 7th. The Japanese fascists had been carrying out hideous atrocities in China and Manchuria, and Pearl Harbor and bombing the Philippines, and what happened later was other horrible atrocities. But it happened to have benign effects, unintended, but it had them. It drove the white man out of Asia. That was extremely important. It saved millions of lives, tens of millions. I mean, India alone probably saved tens of millions of lives. After the British were driven out of India, they no longer suffered the horrifying famines that killed tens of millions of people under British rule, and they were able to resume a path of development that had been stopped 200 years earlier. Okay, that's important. Nobody praises Japanese fascism for that. Or to take the recent period, since the Second World War, there are two major cases of intervention which had substantial benign effects. One is India's invasion of East Pakistan in 1971, which did save tens of millions of lives. The second was Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia in 1979, which terminated the Pol Pot regime's crimes just at the moment when they were escalating. They were peaking in 1978. This is December 1978. Those are two interventions that did have major benign effects. But those are not listed when we talk about benign humanitarian intervention for obvious reasons, wrong agency. Furthermore, the United States was bitterly opposed to both of them. It punished India and threatened it with worse for the crime of invading East Pakistan. The main reason in that case was that that spoiled some planned photo ops for Henry Kissinger, who was planning to go through Pakistan to China. Big excitement, but this kind of ruined it. The Vietnam invasion was a crime because, and in fact, it was terribly criminal. The U.S. Supported a Chinese invasion of Vietnam to punish them for the crime of terminating Khmer Rouge crimes, and the U.S. and Britain immediately turned to supporting Pol Pot diplomatically and militarily. Well, for those reasons, these examples can't be in the canon. If you look for others, you can maybe find some that had benign effects, but it's not so simple. I urge you to try.
Okay, thank you. We will take... yes, could we get a microphone here, please? And again, just if you tell us who you are and if you could make your question short, that would be a great help. The mic is on its way. It's getting there. It's there. Yes.
Thank you. William Shabas, Irish Center for Human Rights in Galway. At last year's lecture, Michael Ignatieff, in a response to a difficult question, said, "I'm no Chomsky. If you came looking for Chomsky, you'll be disappointed." Disappointed we were, and it's a pleasure to have the real thing here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. My question is about nuclear weapons. You were cited in this morning's Irish Times talking about the possibility that Iran might get nuclear weapons. And I think that it might be a statement that's difficult for some people to understand because of some of the appalling things that the current president of Iran has been saying. What can you tell us about the issue of nuclear weapons and their connection with terrorism? Can we say that those states that stockpile and possess nuclear weapons are themselves committing acts of terrorism?
Well, there was a World Court decision on that, unanimous in, I think, 1996, which declared that the states with nuclear weapons are under a legal obligation to observe their commitment in the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1970, Article 6, to undertake good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons. All the nuclear states are in violation of their commitment. The United States far in the lead because it rejects it flatly and explicitly. There's actually an interesting column today in the British London Financial Times by Zelig Harrison, who's one of the leading specialists on this topic. He points out that the U.S., that Europe is guilty of almost compelling Iran to develop nuclear weapons because under U.S. influence, in its usual cowardly fashion, Europe has refused to implement the bargain that was made with Iran. There was a bargain between the European Union and Iran. You only hear half of it. He quoted the other half. The bargain was that Iran would not carry out enrichment of fissile materials if Europe would agree to discuss the issues of security for the region. Now, that's a way of referring to the threats of the United States and Israel to bomb Iran. So if Europe would agree to enter into a discussion of the general security issues, then Iran would stop enriching fissile materials. Well, under U.S. pressure, Europe just backed off. You haven't read anything about that or probably even seen it. And as he points out, that's almost telling Iran you better develop nuclear weapons as a deterrent. And he also points out exactly what you said. He said the refusal of the, and this is what's highlighted in the Financial Times, a separate headline, that the nuclear weapon states are in the most serious violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Technically, Iran's not in any violation of it, but the nuclear states are in violation and are not only refusing to accept it, but in the case of the United States, he didn't go on to say this, in the case of the United States, there are, in fact, increasing the development of nuclear weapons. Should this be called terrorism? It's a little bit like asking whether the invasion of, the terrorist war in Nicaragua should be called aggression. Meaning crime, highest supreme international crime for which people were hanged at Nuremberg. Technically, yes. Technically, this is way beyond terrorism. I mean, remember, development of nuclear weapons means destroying the species, almost inevitably.
Okay, this is where it's very useful to wear a very bright jumper. There's a man with a striped jumper here in the front row. Could we get a microphone to him, please? Yes.
Yes, Richard Boyd Barrett from the Irish Anti-War Movement. I'd just like to add my congratulations to Professor Chomsky. It's such a breath of fresh air to hear a bit of the truth about the war on terror compared to what we get in much of the mainstream media. I just have two questions, really. You may know that about 300,000 US troops have gone through Shannon this year on the way to Iraq, about 500,000 since the war began. And about 50 to 60 of the CIA rendition flights have also gone through here, which the Irish government refused to search. I wonder, would you agree with many people, I think, in this country, and certainly with the anti-war movement, that by the Irish government allowing US troops in those numbers, which have dramatically increased since the war started, going through Shannon en route to Iraq, that they are in fact complicit with terrorism, with war crimes, and with breaches of international human rights? And secondly, again, you may know that the same international coordination of anti-war organizations that called for the huge demonstrations on February the 15th, 2003, have called for demonstrations on March the 18th and March the 19th right across the world, calling for an end to the occupation of Iraq. And I wonder, would Professor Chomsky say a word about certainly what I would see is the vital importance to put the anti-war movement back on the streets again for people to organise against the occupation and
okay.
against the US
okay.
terrorist war.
Okay, thank you.
Second one is easy to answer. Yes, it's very important. And in fact, recall that that means supporting the overwhelming majority of the population of Iraq, as far as we know. They're not taking polls anymore, apparently, because they're coming out the wrong way. But some are being taken and leaked. The British Defense Ministry took a poll last August. It was leaked to the right-wing British press. According to its results, which are confirmed by the Brookings Institute in the United States, over 80% of the population wants the occupying forces out, either immediately or quickly. Almost half the population accepts attacks against the occupying forces as legitimate, and a smashing 1% of the population thinks that they bring higher security. And other evidence tends to support that. So the demonstration is actually in support of the population of Iraq, as far as we know. On the first question, I can only respond conditionally. I don't know the facts. I understood, Stan, in fact, I just learned at the reception before this meeting that there is a parliamentary investigation of some sort that's going to be underway to determine the facts about what's going on in Shannon, and I hope it succeeds. But if what you say is correct, and if, in fact, even part of it is correct, that's participation in what was declared at Nuremberg to be, I'll quote it, the supreme international crime, which encompasses within itself all of the evil that follows, all of the evil that follows. Participation in that is, yes, a crime. And from then on, it's up to it's your business.
You're a diplomat as well, I can see. There's somebody here somebody at the end of the row down here, please, man in red, could we get a microphone to him? Yeah.
Good evening, Professor Chomsky. I'm a media student here in Dublin for some terrible pass-ins. I just wanted to ask you, what do you feel is the real reason behind the current American campaign? Is it economical, ego, I don't know, and has it gone to the point where there is no feasible exit strategy?
Well, we can defer on this question to, as in the case of withdrawal, to the victims. Always makes sense to pay attention to the victims. There was a poll taken in a Gallup poll, the main polling organization in Baghdad, very nicely timed. It was timed right after the president had given a speech declaring his messianic mission to bring democracy to the Iraq and the world and so on. Liberal press hailed it as meant that this was the most noble war in history and on and on. A couple of days after that, the results of the poll were released in Baghdad. People were asked an open question, why did they think that the United States and Britain invaded Iraq? And there were some who agreed with Western, near unanimous Western opinion that it was to bring democracy and freedom and so on, 1%. 1% said the United States and Britain invaded to bring democracy. 5% said they invaded to help the Iraqi people. And most of the rest said what ought to be obvious to anyone who's not really deeply enfeebled by intentional ignorance. The rest of them said that the purpose of the invasion was to take over the immense resources of Iraq and strengthen the U.S. position, Britain behind it, of domination of the world's energy resources and to support Israel's objectives secondarily. I mean, that can't fail to be true. We're not allowed to say it. It's under a ban. You're not allowed to say that. It's called a conspiracy theory or Marxist or some other bad name. But what it is just elementary common sense. I mean, we shouldn't even be talking about it. So, yes, that's the reason. Now, getting back to Well, getting back to exit strategies, the fact that we are so, the West is so disciplined that nobody virtually can mention the obvious truth entails that almost all the discussion of exit strategies is beside the point, literally, almost all of it. Because you can't talk about exit strategy. I mean, you know, the Pentagon can figure out how to get the troops out. They don't need our advice. You can't talk seriously about exit strategies until you answer the question why the United States and Britain are determined not to leave. Okay, for the United States and Britain to permit a sovereign and moderately democratic Iraq would be a nightmare for them. And it just takes a few minutes to think it through. What would be the policies of a sovereign and moderately democratic Iraq? Well, have a Shiite majority. Okay, the Shiite majority would much prefer to have friendly relations with their powerful Shiite neighbor, Iran, than hostile relations. In fact, there already are close relations. A large majority of the clerics in the south are either from Iran, like the Ayatollah Sistani, or have close relations with them. The militias, the major militia that's running much of the south, Badr militia, was trained in Iran, and the connections remain very close. In fact, they're already reestablishing them. The U.S. and Britain call that Iranian interference in Iraqi affairs, which is horrifying. How could a foreign country dare to interfere in Iraq's affairs? You know, horrors. But it's likely that those relations would increase. If that were not bad enough, right across the border in Saudi Arabia, there happens to be a region where there's a Shiite majority that's been bitterly oppressed by the U.S.-backed fundamentalist tyranny, and they've tried occasionally to get some kind of voice, but they're being, just the limited degree of sovereignty that already the Iraqis have won for themselves is already stimulating resistance there, and that'll increase.
So would it be better all in all if Saddam was still there?
Wait a second. There's another point. That happens to be where Saudi oil is, most of it. Okay, just think what this means from the point of view of U.S. and British planners. It means a potential Shiite alliance that controls most of the world's oil and is out of the control of the United States and Britain. Okay, and will probably turn towards the east. You know, they've probably given up. Iran has probably given up by now on European cowardice and may very well turn to China, which isn't intimidated by the United States, unlike Europe. That's why there's so much fear of China. And they're already starting to do that. China's beginning to invest in not only Iran, but even in Saudi Arabia. I mean, you can't imagine a worse nightmare for Washington and London. It's like the end of the world. That's why they can't simply withdraw, and they only will if there's very powerful pressure inside the United States and Britain, elsewhere in Europe, to compel them to do this. But the anti-war movement can't face this fact unless it's willing to recognize the elementary truths that we are not allowed to think about because we are under doctrinal control so rigid that they probably couldn't achieve it in North Korea. You know, that's literally the case. I mean, these are the most elementary facts about exit strategies. Have you seen them discussed? Well, actually, you know, there are a few places, but very little.
So what about the unthinkable thought? Would it be better if Saddam was still there?
It's better for who? Not for Iraqis. But if you're asking about Washington and London, yeah, that's actually why they supported him in 1991. I mean, in 1991, remember, after the first war, the U.S. and Britain had total control of the area. I mean, it's overwhelming. There was a Shiite rebellion in the south, including rebelling Iraqi generals. They didn't ask for help. They just asked for the U.S. not to permit Saddam Hussein to destroy them. They asked for access to captured Iraqi equipment. U.S. and Britain refused. They authorized Saddam Hussein to use military aircraft to attack them. Later they claimed they'd been hoodwinked. They didn't realize that he was actually going to use the bombers when they authorized it. So there was a brutal massacre, and the reasons are exactly what I said. Thomas Friedman, the chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times, wrote after this that He said the best of all worlds for the United States would be an iron-fisted military junta ruling Iraq the same way Iraq Saddam did, but not Saddam. That's embarrassing now.
Okay.
But since the U.S. couldn't get the best of all worlds, had to get the second best.